This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Bringing you up to speed on the latest in conservation, science, and responsible hunting in Canada. Hey everyone, it's Mark Hall, and you're listening to the Round Canada Podcast. My lead story is a really bizarre case in the Northwest Territories. So wildlife officials in the NWT have opened an investigation into a whole bunch of caribou that were found dead on the Gatcho Q Diamond Mine Winter Road. There was about a dozen caribou by the looks of it, and one of the reports I read, that were basically like they were shot and dumped on the side of the road or processed on the side of the road. And there was really poor utilization of the meat and, you know, and all parts of the animal. So it's obviously broken NWT, utilization laws for harvesting wild animals. And I was also reading comments on Facebook and stuff from a lot of the Indigenous people in the Northwest Territories that were, you know, talking about, you know, things like, you know, the hide being left behind and the legs and things that elders do with the legs and boiling them up. And so they saw far more than just the meat, you know, like neck meat and rib meat and that sort of stuff being wasted. But they also saw like all the other parts of the animal being wasted, like the entire heads. And I know in some Northern cultures, I had a Indigenous fellow from the Northwest Territories in a class one time that I talked, and he said his grandmother used to love to take the caribou head, like skinned out, and just put it on a pan in the oven and roast the whole thing because there's so much meat on the head, like on the top and the jaw muscles and stuff, and lots of fat, so it was moist and everything. And he said, yeah, that was like her favorite part of the whole caribou. So all the heads were left there, the antlers and everything. And so really, really bizarre case. You know what it looked like to me looking at the pictures, and I'll tell you where you can go look at them in a minute here. Is somebody killed the caribou, and all they did is just took like an axe by the looks of it, and they just chopped off like the hindquarters, in some cases the front shoulders, and then just split the hide down the back and took the back strap off, and the whole entire animal was just laying there. And you know, that's a fair bit of the meat, but it's not all the meat, like I was saying, plus, you know, other usable parts off of it. So if you wildlife officials got the report through a Facebook post of the person that found all these dead caribou up in the Northwest Territories on the side of the diamond mine Winter Road. So if you go to Facebook, I mean, if you search this story, it's on cabinradio.ca, the news outlet from the north. And it's, what's the title here? Caribou Wastage Investigation Over Winter Road Carcasses. In that article, there's a link to the Facebook post that has all the pictures of the person that found it and was quite upset about it. If you want to go directly onto Facebook and search and have a look at this story for yourself. The person's name who these photos were posted to was Keegan Black hyphen Fowler. And that's the link that's in the news story. It just takes you directly to that individual's Facebook page, and you can read all the comments from folks up there in the NWT and how they're upset about that. This is not the first time this has happened on these winter ice roads into the diamond mines and whatnot in the north. And yeah, there's a few comments in there where people are just kind of fed up with the fact that you know, that people can travel these roads and actually hunt on them. They're kind of like, one, upset that the roads are in the Northwest Territories, but also just sort of like people need to be kept off of them. You shouldn't be allowed to hunt off these roads at all. So it's an ongoing problem. And like anything, wildlife officials in the NWT are hoping that someone has some information, you know, can come forward with a tip. Otherwise, man, it's going to be pretty hard. They'd probably have to do some DNA stuff and, you know, correlate some meat in somebody's freezer back to the animals that were at this carcass site. Speaking of caribou, Alberta has endangered caribou, endangered caribou habitat and endangered caribou herds in the north. A number of years ago, the Alberta government and the federal government signed an agreement under, it's called a Section 11 agreement under the Federal Species at Risk Act, that the province was going to come up with plans and implement a bunch of stuff to reverse the trends of the endangered caribou herds. That's sort of the thing that takes place between the federal government and the provincial government when the federal government doesn't like what the province is doing with a federally listed endangered wildlife species. The federal government under SARA, Species at Risk Act, has the power to come in and draw a circle around a huge area of any province or territory in Canada and impose restrictions on the province to protect endangered species. They don't normally do that. They almost will let the species go extinct before they'll ever exercise those powerful provisions of the Federal Species at Risk Act. So anyways, Alberta government and federal government have this agreement, and it's 15 threatened caribou herds in Alberta. So recently a report came out that various journalists and news outlets in Canada picked up on, that suggesting that the Alberta government has not made much progress since the signing of this agreement a few years ago with the federal government on these 15 caribou herds. The areas in question where these 15 caribou herds live, they're still being subject to human disturbance, including like oil and gas and forestry and recreation activities in the endangered caribou herds. And this report, or sort of like, you know, checkup on how the Alberta government is doing, said that the amount of disturbance from people, industrial and recreation, has gone up between 2018 and 2021. In 23 out of the 28 caribou subranges in northern Alberta. So yeah, that's why people saying things are not getting better. They're actually getting worse for these endangered caribou herds. So of the 15 herds, The recent report said that the Alberta government is confident that 8 of those herds are stable. They're not getting better. They're not getting worse. They're just kind of, quote unquote, holding their own. One of the herds is confirmed to be shrinking. And of the remaining herds out of the 15, nobody's really quite sure by the sounds of it of what's going on. They could be doing okay. They could be getting worse. So it's kind of strange that nobody actually knows. So the Alberta government has developed what's called range plans. They're supposed to be all finished, 15 of them for the 15 herds, by the end of 2025. So like a whole 2 more years, really. And 2 of them have been completed, a government official said, but they have not been given power under provincial legislation to be implemented. So it's just this ongoing saga in Canada with the endangered caribou from, you know, whether it's BC or Alberta or Quebec or Ontario. It's just a struggle to have governments get together and put caribou first. So speaking of another threatened species in Canada and what's going on with it, you know, over the last year and a bit, or maybe a bit longer, I've been talking about this Elver fishery in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. Last year, everything just went to hell on the rivers, and there were like licensed commercial fishermen, there were indigenous constitutional fishers, there were poachers all mixed in. They're out there on these rivers at nighttime fishing these elvers, which are the baby American eels. They're clear, so they're called glass eels. Now, the issue here is that these little eels, they're like the size of a pencil or smaller, and they're clear. They're fished from the rivers and the estuaries on the coastlines throughout Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and then they're shipped live over to Asia. And they get about $5,000 a kilogram for these baby elvers. So that's like a, I'm just trying to maybe guess what that would be. It's like if you took a Ziploc bag, you know, like a sandwich bag, not the big freezer bags, and filled that up with, you know, the elvers, like that's probably about a kilogram. And that's $5,000. So imagine like scooping up like 100 pounds of those things, you know, at night, one person. Like that's why there's like an illegal harvest as well. The federal government is trying to, because it's federal government DFO that manages this. You know, they have rates, harvesting quotas set for the licensed commercial fishermen, as well as for the various First Nations, because they have a legal right to earn a moderate livelihood from this fishing. Basically, it was a free-for-all the last couple of years, and DFO enforcement officers just had to be like, that's it, we're out. You know, they were in the rivers at nighttime with, like I said, different people that were allowed to be there and weren't allowed to be there. There were violence going on. I can't remember if some of the stories of, you know, weapons being involved and stuff, but it was like bad, really, really bad. And DFO just said, hey, we can't enforce these laws. And they shut the fishery down early last April, I believe it was. So anyways, just recently, the federal government made an announcement that it's planning to close the entire Elver fishery for the 2024 season because it cannot manage a safe and sustainable fishery because of the violence and the poaching, you know, basically. So this has come under fire in Ottawa by the opposition, saying, like, how is taking legal harvesters off the river going to stop the poaching? And the response that I saw to that was, because the federal government isn't able to manage indigenous harvesting, commercial harvesting, and separate that out from the poachers, it can't enforce anything. So the closure is going to mean anybody that's there fishing is illegal. And so it'll narrow down the ability of enforcement officers just to enforce illegal fishing on the river. And, of course, that's upset, the commercial fishermen, because that's their livelihood. That might be their only source of income, for the year, because it's, fairly valuable. They might have fairly small quotas that, maybe a commercial fisherman gets his entire quota in one evening and that's it. And it's like, might seem like a lot of money for a little bit of work. But, if you got a whole family that you're trying to raise in business expenses for the rest of the year, it might not be quite as lucrative. If you're a poacher and you're getting in there, taking whatever you can get and getting black market prices for it, then you probably, it's free cash basically, right? That's poaching. That's the illicit wildlife trade in a nutshell. First Nations are very upset about this announcement by the federal government. Some First Nations have said that they've submitted proposals to the federal government to have a First Nations moderate livelihood fishery, because this closure is impacting on their treaty rights and their right to earn a moderate livelihood. Now, one of the First Nations representatives that I read in one of the stories said that their proposal was for DFO to increase the total allowable catch for First Nations. And the rationale there was that by giving more quota, increasing the quota for indigenous fishermen, that would help stop and curb the illegal black market trade in the Elvers, because there would be more monitoring of, folks on the river. And anyways, the federal government just outright rejected that idea, and they're moving forward with the proposal to close the fisheries for 2024. The American eel is listed by the government of Canada as a threatened wildlife species in Canada, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick. Really unfortunate story coming out of Ontario here this winter. The Canadian Wildlife Health Cooperative has been monitoring Canada geese in Ontario that have contracted the avian influenza, the bird flu, avian flu. And it's apparently pretty bad this year. People are basically going out and collecting the geese that are sick and dying and stuff, and taking them to a facility to humanely euthanize them, and then to get their carcasses away from scavenging predatory birds and whatnot, because they can get the avian flu as well, like eagles, and then they die from it. So there was a really bizarre story earlier this winter out of Alaska. The first confirmed case of a polar bear, I believe, died. They confirmed that it died of the avian influenza. So, gosh, just a crazy, crazy world nowadays with these wildlife diseases. Of course, along that lines, for diseases, the first two confirmed cases of chronic wasting disease were discovered in the province of British Columbia just within the last month. Both of those cases come very, very close to where I live in southern BC, the community of Cranbrook. One was a roadkill that was picked up off the highway, where highways folks will bring the heads in. Trappers are also allowed to pick up roadkill, and they have an obligation to submit the heads for testing. And it was one of the trapper picked up roadkills that was confirmed to have CWD. The other one, that was a white-tailed deer. The other case was a mule deer that was shot by a hunter last October, I believe, quite a ways away from where the roadkill one was, 100 kilometers or so as the crow flies, or 50 kilometers away over a bit of a mountain range. And those test results came back and confirmed that that mule deer buck had chronic wasting disease. So yeah, those are the first two cases in British Columbia. The province is still trying to kind of figure out what it's going to do. It doesn't have much of an operational budget. The state of Montana discovered, like, surprise, surprise, in 2019, discovered chronic wasting disease in the deer living in the town of Libby, Montana, which in a straight line is only 70 kilometers from the province of BC, brings you into the lower Yak areas, Moyet areas, and the Newgate areas, just south of where I live. So it's possible, fairly likely, in my opinion, that the chronic wasting disease deer from Libby, Montana, were probably moving back and forth and transmitting it into deer herds just inside BC, inside the international boundary, probably a number of years ago. So it's unfortunate that when the Libby, Montana cases were confirmed, that the province didn't get down to the international boundary and just intensively sample and test deer along the border. It's very possible we could have picked up on deer on the Canadian side, on the BC side, 5 years or more ago, and then be able to maybe have eradicated it before it moved north. So the deer that were found, that were shot by the hunter and the roadkill, were a ways inside of BC, away from the border. The mule deer probably about 30 kilometers, 25 kilometers from the Montana border, so 100-ish kilometers from Libby, Montana, which is not really a big deal. They had collars on translocated mule deer in that exact area, and those deer were wandering way down into Montana and back and forth. So yeah, it's likely that it's been here for a while. The biggest concern I have is I've looked at data from different jurisdictions around North America, including right next door here in Alberta, that what the pattern seems to be in North America is when chronic wasting disease is first detected, like there's a couple cases and then a few more and then a few more and then a few more, and then it just explodes, you know, to like 30% or more of the population, and the deer are dying out. That inflection point on that graph of sort of like little bit by little bit, and then all of a sudden it's just like, you know, exponential growth in the number of deer that are being confirmed as being infected with CWD, happens between about 6 and 10 years after the first discovery of chronic wasting disease in the jurisdiction. So if the deer from Libby, Montana have been in BC since 2019-ish, we're probably getting very close to that 6-year mark. So we could actually, even though there's only 2 confirmed cases, within the next year or two, see that rapid escalation very, very quickly. And it's not because it's maybe exploding anymore in BC. It's just the fact that we just didn't have the ability in the province to detect it 4 or 5 years ago. And that inflection point is basically where a jurisdiction loses control of it. And there's just no chance of isolating a small pocket of infected deer and eradicating it, which New York State did back in 2005. And I always talk about that because that is a great example of early detection. And the state immediately went into that zone with a really intensive call, and they've been sampling since 2005, and they have not confirmed another case of CWD in the state. So that's a long time from 2005 to 2023, you know, in the last I read of the data. And because of, you know, rapid testing and an intensive call in the epicenter very early after detection, we're not there yet in BC. So hard to say what's going to happen. In Saskatchewan, I'm kind of always mixed about talking about these poaching stories. It's real. you know, there was the big one about the Alpine Carnivore brand TV show, the husband and wife that were charged in both British Columbia and Alberta. That was a big story that was floating around, you know, just a few weeks ago. I was on the CKNW Mike Smythe talk show, talking a little bit about it. If you didn't catch that, I think I got that up on my social media somewhere. I'll link to it. If not, reach out to me. And if you want to listen to that radio interview and my thoughts on that poaching case. But here's another one that's come out of Saskatchewan. Two Manitoba men were handed, this is in Manitoba, not Saskatchewan. Let me clarify this. The men were from Manitoba. The infractions occurred in Saskatchewan. So the two Manitoba men got a 2-year hunting suspension and fines of $13,980 in a Swift Current provincial court after a whole bunch of, you know, investigation work over a year or more's time using DNA again to connect corpses that were found in the field by conservation officers and stuff that was in people's possession. So this is considered actually a pretty substantial case in Saskatchewan. It's 18 animals, moose, mule deer, pronghorn, coyotes, red foxes, and pheasants were all part of the illegal bounty that these two fellas had. They pleaded guilty and took the 2-year hunting suspension and fines of $14,000. So I know what you're thinking. Doesn't seem like a lot, you know. 18 animals is definitely malice. It's intent to commit the crimes and, you know, not honest mistakes. It's a case of malice. It's probably why they committed admitted to their guilt, pleaded guilty to get the lesser charges rather than fighting it, knowing that they would be found guilty and then penalized even more. So, you know, the thing I really found just sort of looking back on the other case, the Alpine Carnivore case, is there's zero tolerance in the hunting community across this country for this sort of stuff. Even though the individuals prior to the offenses are part of our hunting community, they're part of the people that, you know, I'm standing up for, hunting families in Canada, and our advocacy work, you know, at Blood Origins Canada is standing up for hunters' rights. And then all of a sudden, one of them goes and breaks the law, like one of our own. And it happens. It's, you know, it's the real world. But I just really proud of the Canadian hunting community for the stance that the vast majority of, not everybody, the vast majority of people's positions and attitudes towards the Alpine Carnivore TV show hosts' convictions. There's just not a lot of tolerance. They didn't accept the excuses that were made for what happened. And, you know, it was hunters themselves that actually turned in, you know, their own. And I think that's the biggest thing to me that shows how much people care. I don't know about this case in Saskatchewan, if this was a case of, you know, hunters turning it in. But more often than not, I find it's hunters that were the initial ones that were saying there's something going on here. They report it to the conservation officers. They start investigations. One thing leads to another. And there we are with these court convictions. So even though this happens, and this is people from our own hunting community, I'm proud to be part of that hunting community, because there is zero tolerance for this type of stuff. And it doesn't matter who you are, the hunting community will turn you in and will expect, you know, that you pay the consequences. In fact, most people want more severe consequences than what the courts are handing out. So the peers in the hunting community are a tougher crowd than our Canadian judges are. So man, if we ever got into wildlife poaching infractions being judged by a jury of your peers, you know, like in what do they call that? Restorative justice type scenario, man, there'd be some pretty tough sentences handed down. And maybe that's what we need in this country. Maybe we need, they do have it in indigenous communities. I know they do here in British Columbia. The Conservation Officer Service works with indigenous communities to move individuals from the community that have broken the law to a restorative justice program. And it's essentially their own community members and elders and peers in the community that will basically judge them and figure out what the restoration is for the person's action. So that'd be pretty cool to see that happen outside of the indigenous hunting community with the licensed hunters in this country. So I don't know. I think they would be a tougher crowd to face, and maybe that would keep a lot more people on the straight and narrow, knowing that if they got caught, they'd be facing not a lenient judge, but a pretty angry group of their peers. Up in the Yukon, there's this, of all places in Canada, there are Rocky Mountain elk in the Yukon. In the Taquini Valley, they were introduced there back in the 1950s. Another herd was brought into the area of the Taquini Valley in the 1990s. So there was like a couple of pulses of herd introductions. They like it. I remember years ago when they first, just outside of Whitehorse, they opened up the first hunts for these elk, and people were getting bulls that were just enormous, just huge monster things. Like, so, you know, they're doing okay in the Yukon. However, winters are tough in the Yukon, and what these elk herds have done is they've taken up residence on the agriculture areas, private land, farmlands and stuff, and they cause quite a bit of consternation for the farmland owners, the private property owners. This has been going on for decades. Different groups and organizations and steering committees and whatnot trying to find solutions for the elk depredation, you know, of hay crops mostly is what's going on. So, and nobody's really found a solution, you know, the silver bullet. So recently the Yukon government has provided the Yukon Fish and Game Association with $175,000 over the next 2 years so that they can hire an elk agriculture coordinator who's going to try to basically bridge the gap between hunters and hunting as a tool to move elk off the private farmlands and away from stored hay reserves, and to be the conduit between hunters and the ag operators. So that's not, you know, that's not sitting too well with some of the agriculture operators. They're a bit bitter because they've been involved in this process for a couple of decades and just a lot of failed initiatives to really alleviate the problem, the losses of hay for the farmers. So some of the stuff I read is like, they're a little skeptical of, you know, this new program of hiring an elk coordinator for the valley to work with the farm operators. So one of the problems here of hunting elk on private land in the Yukon, in the Taquini Valley, is there's a law in the Yukon that you can't hunt within a kilometer of a residence unless you have permission. So then there's a bunch of clustered farms and farmhouses and stuff in the valley of adjacent property owners. So if you get permission from one property owner to say, yeah, come in and try to get these elk off my property, and you then have to go get permission from the next landowner because you may be within a kilometer of their house. And if they don't give you permission, then it's a no-go. You can't hunt on the land that the one owner has already given you permission on. So apparently this is like one of the barriers of using hunting as a tool to manage these elk herds. I've seen similar things in southern BC where I live. Ag areas, they're producing like straight alfalfa crops, and the elk are heavily hunted, but they're basically, they're like the last inkling of light at night after shooting light is gone. They start to come out of the timber into the fields, and they're gone before shooting light in the morning. Usually like in the dark, you just kind of hear them leaving and their hooves twanging on the metal fences as they jump over the fields, the fences on the edge of the fields and go back into the timber. So it's almost, you know, it's like a moot point that people are in there hunting because, you know, they're not really taking a lot. They're only allowed to shoot bulls, which, you know, so you get a handful of bulls out of the area. It's not really reducing, you know, population. So you start putting pressure on these elk in the Yukon. I would suspect they would probably do the same thing, and they would just move their behavior to being nocturnal. If they can get into the fields and get into the hay areas at night when they can't hunt, the damage is probably going to continue. But hopefully maybe that this elk agriculture coordinator will be able to find some unique solutions, you know, for this problem. And yeah, we'll see what comes of it. Like I said, some of the ranching operators are just, they're skeptical because they have not really seen much action from the government for years and years. One family sued the Yukon government 4 years ago, basically saying that the damages that they were suffering to their hay crops and land was because of the mismanagement of the herd. They said that was negligence on behalf of the government. Yukon Supreme Court threw that case out on the basis that there was no reasonable prospect of success in the court case. That court case was overturned by a territorial court, the Court of Appeal in the Yukon, 2 years ago. And supposedly that the landowner's case against the Yukon government for negligence in managing the herd will go back to court in the Yukon this coming October. Now, another decision that just recently came out a couple of days ago from British Columbia. So there's a First Nations in North Central British Columbia, the Nisga Nation, the Nisga people, First Nations. They signed the first modern treaty with the province of British Columbia 24 years ago in 2020. It's a really interesting story. I've been up there. I've been in their House of Commons, watching a sitting of their legislature years and years ago. Interesting place, interesting history. They, the Nisga people, have been negotiating with the government for this treaty, I believe, in excess of 100 years ago. It's probably getting up to like 130 years ago when they first started negotiating this treaty. So you want to talk about how processes in government move slow? You can imagine how the Nisga people felt when it took like three generations to actually get the modern treaty signed. So kind of the way a modern treaty worked is, you know, there's lands that were given to the Nisga people and said, this is Nisga land. It's a portion of their traditional territory, but it's theirs. It's almost like a transfer of land into fee simple private land. And that's theirs. They had the right to manage their resources, forestry, fisheries, wildlife, hunting, healthcare, the education system. The Nisga people formed a government of elected officials. They adopted British Columbia's legislative framework and government framework so that they could interface with the government officials in BC, like Minister of Forest to Minister of Forest, Minister of Wildlife to Minister of Wildlife, like everything kind of lined up that way. So it's kind of neat. However, like, it's not a clean separation when the treaty signed. There's stuff that was like provisional and transferring and things that had to take, you know, go on for like years and years and years to transition some stuff over to the Nisga'a Nation from the province. So there was some disputes within that treaty agreement about the authority of the Nisga'a people for a bunch of different things, but specifically about hunting. Even though they had their own nation and their own government, the province still was imposing hunting restrictions on grizzly bears, which the province banned back in 2017, moose and mountain goats. So that was one of, and this was an agreement that the Nisga'a Nation and the province of British Columbia came to agreement on outside of the court. So that's kind of like a first in BC. But the Nisga'a Nation's new agreement with the province gives them now the exclusive rights to allow people in the Nisga'a Nation, and I still don't quite know on this, but for sure I am to understand that they are now allowed to grant their own hunting permits for grizzly bears, moose, and mountain goats to hunters anywhere in the Nisga'a territory, which to me would mean outside of the Nisga'a lands, the treaty lands where they have their own governance. Now, whether or not that gives the Nisga'a government authority to issue hunting permits, let's say for grizzly bears that are closed to outfitters within the Nisga'a territory so that they can bring in hunters, or if they had an area where predation rates are high and they needed some help, could they issue tags to BC residents? That part I'm not quite sure on. I'm trying to get some more information on that. Some preliminary information that I've got back through my network is that the Nisga'a's authority to issue permits for grizzly bears is only for Nisga'a people, but it's potentially for anywhere on Nisga'a territory where there's currently a ban imposed by the province of BC. So interesting kind of story of, I like to stay on top of, everything that goes on in the province with Indigenous groups that are pushing the government to get their rights back to allow for grizzly hunting in their traditional territory. So the issue of coyotes in Stanley Park, that's in Vancouver, is a story I've covered over the last couple years. There was one year in just December, I think like two Decembers ago, where like coyotes were like attacking and biting people kind of like every other day sort of thing down there. And so the parks officials and the conservation officers are continuing to capture coyotes and remove them from Stanley Park. There was a big uproar just a few weeks ago when members of the media got a hold of a 38-page document that showed that there were 31 trapping sites in Stanley Park to remove coyotes. And so that kind of got out, and that has got everybody in a big uproar that they're continuing to trap coyotes in Stanley Park. Between December 2020 and August of 2021, there were 45 coyote attacks in Stanley Park. That led to 11 wolves. Yeah, that would be something, eh? 11 coyotes being culled and taken out of Stanley Park. So that's still going on down there. And 31 trapping locations doesn't mean 31 coyotes. It's 31 trapping locations might be needed to get like 4 coyotes or something. So, just looking at the map here, and yeah, there's like a grid across all of Stanley Park of trapping sites in the park. And man, I get it that people don't want to see coyotes killed. The animal rights people that want to coexist and have coyotes sort of like living side by side with picnickers in Stanley Park as their coyotes are running around trying to, kill the big gray squirrels and whatnot. But it's just not a recipe for coexistence somewhere like that. And, you know, sooner or later, a kid is going to get killed, or at some point we're going to end up with that disease that was discovered up in the Edmonton area a few years ago that's transmitted by coyotes, and people can get a parasite in their liver. It's really hard to detect, but it can be fatal. 15 people were confirmed in northern Alberta to have contracted this parasite that's goes from coyotes to coyote poop to dogs, like domestic dogs out being walked, to their owners. And that's sort of the transmission channel of getting it in. It hasn't been confirmed in BC, but, you know, gosh, the earlier stories I talked about the avian flu and CWD and stuff, it's like, it's only a matter of time where that parasite spreads throughout more populations in Alberta and makes its way to BC. Now, when we're talking about, you know, coexistence of coyotes in urban areas, we're talking about the risk of people getting a disease from them that are fatal. And I've always been an advocate that wildlife need habitat that's protected, which also includes human habitat. Like, humans need their own habitat. They need to guard it and protect it. And just like any animal does, a wolf pack protects their territory. You know, a moose has its own habitat. We're just animals on the landscape that have habitat as well. And in a lot of cases, it's not in the best interest, in my opinion, for humans to allow certain wildlife species to coexist in humans' habitat. Bears, cougars, coyotes, big animals like moose and elk and deer, it's just not the best recipe. And yeah, some of humans' habitat is pretty darn big. I get it. But, you know, I think society needs to make a decision about, you know, making sure that there's good, secure habitat outside of human habitat for all the other species to exist. And I guess be a little bit more animal-like in the animal world and protect your own habitat from things that could cause you problems. I know the animal rights people are trying to say we can coexist with them here, but time and time and time again, I just see examples where it's just not always possible. So I think it's not possible for coyotes to live in Stanley Park in very many numbers without them getting into situations where they feel the need to bite people, most likely to protect something themselves or whatever. So anyways, the ongoing saga of coyotes in Stanley Park continues. They're trying to get rid of more of them over the course of this winter, and people don't want coyotes to be removed from Stanley Park. So that's what's going on around Canada. You're up to date. And if you got any questions or stories or anything you want me to cover from your neck of the woods in Canada, drop me a message. Mark@bloodorigins.com. Send me a news story. Give me some details about what you know about it on the ground, because that's where some of the best intel comes from on these stories, is people that are actually there living it, as opposed to gleaning it from the perspective of, you know, a big city reporter, so to speak. So let me know, or find me on social media, find Blood Origins Canada on Instagram, and send us a DM and say, hey, here's a really cool story, and I'll put it on the list for another episode of Around Canada. All right, folks, thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.